He is a man who can bridge cultures and understands history and scholarship and politics and theology and philosophy.
My guest this week is an author, a filmmaker, a former policy advisor to Ronald Reagan,
Mr. Dinesh D'Souza.
This American dream is a dream not just of economic opportunity or success, but it's ultimately a dream where you can be the architect of your own destiny.
I grew up in a different world, actually a world without America. And although I grew up without phone, without television, without hot water, we had a car, but if you looked down the floor of our car, you could see the ground.
He's been described as an influential conservative thinker. He's a best-selling author, political commentator, and filmmaker.
The great man, Dinesh D'Souza, a patriotic man.
No longer would I say that I live in a rarefied world of intellectual debate. I've seen the upside of America, and I've seen the downside of America. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't trade the United States for any other country. At the end of the day, my enthusiasm for American government may have been, but my enthusiasm for this country burns brighter than ever. Thank you very much. Up. This is fantastic. Wow. I am very honored and thrilled to be here. Very pleased. I'm accompanied by my wife, Debbie. Honey, want to stand up and say hello? We've actually been in Munich and Nuremberg and Prague. Shooting some scenes for a new movie to come out this summer. You know, for those of us who thought that the election would settle things down a little bit, that there would be some post-mortem grumpiness on the part of the left, but that they would digest the outcome like good Democrats. Yeah. But then it never ends. I mean, just today, as we were flying over here, I turn on CNN, and of course, the Russia indictments. They basically got a bunch of guys who are probably sitting around right now drinking vodka in Moscow. And there was a sort of desperate effort to kind of collate two things that are really quite different. On the one hand, would the Russians like to influence our election? And on the other hand, the completely separate matter, did Trump collude with Russia to fix the outcome? But on CNN, you could tell they were kind of upset because Mueller was only going with the first and wasn't opening the door on the second. And so you could begin to see, even though they were trying to make a lot of it, the same kind of constipated expressions on the faces of these hosts that I remember so vividly from election night. And they had worked so hard to drag the crooked hag across the finish line. But, you know, when I see all the craziness in American politics now, I try to rise above it, but I keep finding myself being pulled into it. I try to remember. Debbie and I we're both immigrants. Debbie's from Venezuela. I grew up in Mumbai, India. We came to America, and we're both Reaganites. We're creatures of the Reagan Revolution. Yeah. And of course, I can't deny that there are times now when I kind of pine for the gentleman's politics that characterized that era. Even though Reagan and Tip O'Neill might have a political squabble or brawl, it was conceivable that they would go out and have a Guinness afterward. They didn't actually do that, but they conceivably could. That is actually not the America we live in now. And so we have this out there guy, Trump. And he is a very different character, as you know, than Reagan. So Reagan was a man who, in a sense, I believe Reagan thought that you can't change the world in 25 different ways. You can maybe change the world in one or two ways. And so the job of the president was to focus laser-like on one or two things, and don't worry too much about the rest of it. So Reagan focused on the Soviet Empire, he focused on inflation, Central America, privatization. That's pretty much it. Reagan's view was the rest of it, I'm just going to let it go. I'm going to try to bring about change in these critical areas. And he did. Trump fights on all fronts. And this guy is pulling us out of the trade pact. And at the same time, he saved the court. And then he did tax reform. And then he's trying to deliver some blows to Obamacare. And in the middle of this, he finds time to swat Meryl Streep, take on Saturday Night Live. So this guy at the age of 71 is energetic on all fronts and is also fighting not only the political war, but the culture war. Now, this is actually very important because typically as Republicans, we focus on the political fight. But we do need to realize that that is actually just a corner of the battlefield. And that the most powerful adversaries that we have now are actually not the Democratic Party. If this was a straight out fight between Republicans and Democrats, we would probably be able to give them a pretty regular swatting. But in fact, the most powerful forces arrayed against Trump are not Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. They're not even the little creepy Antifa guys who have come out of, Bernie's basement. Where's my mask? Where's my bike lock? No. The most dangerous adversaries we face are in academia.
Yep.
And in the media. And in the entertainment industry, by which I don't just mean Hollywood, but I mean also the whole world of music and Broadway and the whole comedy industry. I mean, every day Trump is flayed nonstop on a whole bunch of platforms. And if you look at just the world of comedy, on the left you have Bill Maher, Colbert, Jon Stewart, John Oliver, Ellen, Rosie O'Donnell. The list goes on and on and on, never stops. We have almost nothing equivalent on our side to take on this. And a lot of young people today get not only their style, their sense of humor, but they actually get their political opinions from these comedians. Jimmy Kimmel. So this suggests that, in fact, the left has weapons that go far beyond the political. They occupy, they own the biggest megaphones of the culture. And when I say own, I mean own. The political victories we win are temporary. They can be reversed in the next election. But how do we take the universities back? Do we have campuses of our own? Can we actually ever get back that real estate that the left has almost monopolized to the point that they can actually drive our speakers and our opinions off campus? So this is the broader landscape, and Trump instinctively understands this. He's immersed in the culture, and he has weapons that he's willing to use, including that little crazy weapon called Twitter. And it's really funny because I just read a little item that says, you know, Melania and Ivanka have been working together to try to take away Trump's Twitter. Happily, he's not giving it up. And then there are all these Republicans. Once in a while, I have to admit this group includes my wife. Take away Trump's Twitter. And I'm like, take away Trump's Twitter and do what? Give it to Romney? What would he do with it? Look, the thuggishness of the left that we see every day is a confirmation to us that this is why, at this moment in our history, I believe there is no one who is up to the task better than Trump. Yeah. All right. I don't know anybody who can take a punch better than that guy. And he knows how to throw a punch. Now, he does get into all kinds of fights, and he cannot resist. If you hit at Trump, he will hit back at you. And it doesn't matter if you're the dog catcher in Missouri, you're gonna get it. That is Trump's nature. But for all those who say, well, you know, this is a style that the Republicans are not used to. See, the problem was, for many years, when I go around speaking on campus and speaking to Republican groups, people would say, how is it that when the Republicans win the House and the Senate, and then even earlier the presidency, we still seem to be on the defensive? We still seem to be up against the wall. Our leaders still seem to be wimps. What's up with them? And reflecting on this, it occurs to me that the reason that our guys behave that way, our leaders, is because they are terrified of the media. They know that the media has the power, reputationally, to assassinate. And if the media were to put a McConnell, a Paul Ryan in its sights, and go after them for 3 months straight, again, we're not just talking about New York Times articles and editorials. We're talking about making them the objects of savage ridicule, constant demands for their resignation, hundreds of reporters in their hometowns interviewing all their friends, amplifying every negative statement, finding everybody who hates them, and putting them on the front page. Our leaders know that they cannot take this. And that at the end of the 3 months, their reputations would be so tattered that their own side, we, would bury them. And this is why they act in this sort of timid, baffled, invertebrate manner. And that is, they don't know how to cope with the media. Now, that's not entirely their fault. Partly, we have to admit, it's our fault. Because we have allowed the left to assume this incredibly dominant position in the big megaphones that get out information to the American people. Now, since Trump's election, American politics has been, you have to admit, a completely abnormal, surreal affair. Surreal. Although there have been issues that have come to the surface, there has not really been a legitimate debate on any issue. On immigration, on healthcare, even on tax reform. Why? Because there has been such a muddying of the water that there is no ability to have a debate. Essentially, what's happened is that the left has dropped two of its most incendiary cards. One, a very familiar one, the race card. Trump is a racist. And it used to be people would talk about prejudice, and then prejudice sort of became racial discrimination, and racial discrimination became racism. The umbrella term now is white supremacy. Trump is a white supremacist, and the Republican Party is the party of white supremacy. Now, we've heard this before. The race card is played by the left every time, because every time they play it, it works. Our side goes on the complete defensive, and to such a point that the left is able to promote, in a sense you could say, big lies about the Republican Party. The Republican Party is the party of bigotry. The Republican Party is the party of white supremacy. A few years ago, a very nice guy, I believe he's now at my former institute, the American Enterprise Institute, Ken Melman, the head of the RNC, actually went to the NAACP and apologized for the racist history of the Republican Party. No, I say this because a big lie has enormous power if you can get the target of the lie to believe it. If you can get the very guy you're lying about to, it's almost like this show on Netflix that Debbie and I watch, essentially people who falsely confess to crimes that they never committed. Of course, the interesting question being, what would make someone do that? But in politics, we do that. And with Trump, the race card has been, the ante has been upped even further with a new card, and that is the fascism card. Trump isn't just a racist, he's a fascist. And fascism is, fascism and a certain kind of neo-Nazism are said to be familiar phenomena on the right. Describing Republicans, conservatives, patriots, Christians. Now, again, if I remember back, once in a while people would call Reagan a fascist, or they would call Bush a fascist. But it was a throwaway kind of insult. Reagan's a fascist, but they wouldn't really do anything with that. It was just kind of a way of saying they didn't like Reagan. But with Trump, the media means it. They're pressing it as if we are living America now in, this is sort of like Germany in 1933. Trump is an early manifestation of Hitler. True, he hasn't done the Holocaust, but it could go there. It could go there. And the reason I say this is because this is the actual justification for all of this crazy behavior that we see on the left every day. Behavior that otherwise would be very difficult to justify. I mean, think about this. Ever since Trump's election, you have mainstream Democrats saying, we're going to boycott Trump's inauguration. Now, imagine if we had boycotted Obama's inauguration. Imagine how apoplectic the press would be if that happened. Massive violent disruptions of inaugural ceremonies and inauguration parties, unheard of, and at least in my lifetime in American politics. This kind of, and then it's never stopped. The Antifa thugs on the campus, this whole effort to engineer, I mean, almost blatantly to engineer a kind of coup against Trump. Get him out of there by any means necessary. All of this is justified by this claim that Trump is a fascist and that fascism is a phenomenon of the right. Now, I use the title The Big Lie in my most recent book because Hitler said something quite striking about the subject. Hitler coined this phrase, the big lie. And Hitler basically says that small lies are actually pretty easy to detect. If somebody gives a small lie, the whole business in Benghazi was due to a video. That's a lie, but it's kind of a small lie because you can sort of compare it to what the real situation is, and it's very easy to check. Obama. If you want to keep your doctor, you can. That's a lie, but it's kind of a small lie. Why? Because you can immediately verify whether it's true or not. But Hitler's point is that a big lie is not like this. A big lie is so big that you can't get your head around it. And it's very difficult to refute. The ordinary guy doesn't have a clue how to do that. So let's say that somebody were to say, communism is on the left, but fascism is on the right. And in keeping with this, the right has been getting more and more fascist under Trump. Now that's a big lie. And in fact, that's a lie that precedes Trump. It long predates Trump. This is a lie that was invented in 1945. In fact, it was invented right as American troops were going into the concentration camps, and out were coming those ghostly, emaciated, tottering figures. And right away, emotionally, intellectually, morally, fascism and Nazism were permanently discredited. And at that moment, the young progressives who were coming to power in America, in the academy, in the universities, in the media, in Hollywood, these are people who actually knew that there had been deep and close associations between fascism and the Democratic Party, between fascism and American progressives. But they also knew that if they let that cat out of the bag, a whole generation of young people would have no interest in progressivism or the Democratic Party. And so they realized that this history, recent history, had to be completely buried and, in a sense, made to disappear. One of the things that's most striking to me in my own work is that we talk a lot about fake news, but my work focuses on fake scholarship, fake history. Not so much the news story, but you could call it the meta story, the story behind the story. Because when you look at the news, there's a kind of governing background narrative that's driving the news. That's the meta story. And we have seen both in the area of race and now in the area of fascism. The race card and the fascism card are very close because, of course, fascism, at least National Socialism, Hitler's fascism, was racist. So the left is firing on both these big guns. And see, the typical Republican, the typical gentlemanly response is, this is all so ugly and so unfortunate. Let's try to focus the debate on taxes, or let's try to focus the debate on the things that matter to most Americans. And when we say that, what the left hears us say is, we're scared of the topic. We don't know how to answer these allegations. So their point is, let's keep it up. Let's ramp it up. Why? Because we've got the Republicans running scared. They want to change the subject. Well, we're not going to let them. And so the remarkable thing is that these cards, the race card and the fascism card, are both based on huge big lies that are coming from the left. And the lies are so big, and see, remember, when you dominate academia and the media and Hollywood, you're able to create what you can call the ricochet effect. A professor writes a book about fascism being on the right. 10 of his colleagues claim it's the greatest book ever written. And then he finds himself on CNN. His book is reviewed in the New York Review of Books. And pretty soon Michael Moore gets wind of it, or Steven Spielberg, and they make a documentary or they make a movie on it. And so for the ordinary guy, you're hearing this message in all kinds of different forums, and at a certain point it occurs to you, it must be true. It must be true. How can fascism be on anything other than the right when that's all I've ever heard? That's what every textbook has told me. No one has ever said any different. In my own work, this has been a kind of problem for me, because when I go and speak on campus, I'll tell the students, I'm about to tell you a bunch of things that you have never heard in your life. And this will surprise you because here you are, a junior at the University of California at Berkeley or at Duke, and you consider yourself to be a pretty sophisticated person and pretty smart, and you've learned a lot. But the things I'm going to tell you don't just disagree with what you've heard, but they flatly contradict your entire worldview, not based upon rival opinions, but based upon undeniable facts. But you will find it very difficult to believe these facts. In fact, it's going to cross your mind that I must be lying. Because if I wasn't lying, why haven't you ever read this anywhere else? And this is sort of the dilemma of my work, not only my books, but my movies, where I have to actually say things and force the other side to challenge them. Whenever I speak on campus about the race issue, I'd always get professors, I talk about the racist history of the Democratic Party, and some professor would inevitably say something like this: "Well, Dinesh, you know, you've made some interesting points, but what you're telling me is rather simplistic, because as you would have to admit, there's plenty of blame to go around. Slavery, yes, it's a problem that affected the whole country, both parties were involved in it." So this is the kind of thing that really gets me. I mean, when I see this kind of squid-like cloud emanate from a professor, I mean, I have the overwhelming desire to want to puncture it. And so in the movie last year, in Hillary's America, I made the following statement. I said, in 1860, the year before the Civil War, no Republican owned a slave. Not no Republican leader owned a slave, but no Republican in the United States owned a slave. All the slaves in the country, 4 million of them, every single one of those slaves was owned by a Democrat. Well, now this is what I call fighting words. It's a statement that is so crushing. If it's true, first of all, it's a statement that appears in no history book. It's a statement that appears, in fact, in no book at all, like, other than mine. It's a statement that has never appeared, as far as I know, in any newspaper article or magazine article ever. And yet, as Richard Nixon said, it has the merit of being true. Now here's the point. I put the statement out, and it's a scientific statement in the sense that it's beautiful. All you have to do, it's very easy to refute. All you have to do is give me the name of one Republican who owned a slave, and I would have to take it back. But now, 15 months later, there's not a single counterexample that anyone has ever been able to give me. One guy wrote me about 4 months ago, a PhD student. He goes, "I've been doing some extensive research, Dinesh, and I gotcha. Ulysses S. Grant inherited a slave on his wife's side, one slave." And I said, "Well, this is actually a very impressive effort. It would have been normally a touche, but I do want to point out to you that at the time that this happened, Ulysses S. Grant was a Democrat." He became a Republican later. Now, the reason this is significant is because here we have the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party is the party of the slave plantation. The Democratic Party is the only party, actually, in the history of the world to argue that slavery is good, not only for the master, it's good for the slave. Think about the chutzpah of saying this. This is called the positive good school of slavery. I mean, even Hitler didn't have the chutzpah to say, "What I'm doing to the Jews is good for the Jews." The Nazis didn't go there, but the Democrats did. And then after slavery, the Democrats became the party of Jim Crow, of segregation, of the Ku Klux Klan, of racial terrorism. If you were to make a list of the 100 top leaders of the KKK from the 1860s to the present, 99% of those guys would be Democrats. This is the actual history of the party. And so, just think of the genius, even the civil rights movement, The civil rights movement was a movement that would have been impossible without the votes of the Republican Party. More Republicans proportionally voted for the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Fair Housing Act of 68. The main opposition to civil rights came from the Democratic Party, and all the bad guys of the civil rights movement, the Birmingham Sheriff Bull Connor, who was putting dogs and hoses on Martin Luther King, and Orville Faubus, the Arkansas governor, who stood at the gates of the schoolhouse and blocked black kids from going to school, by the way, a mentor to Bill Clinton. All these guys were Democrats. So this is the actual history of the Democratic Party. Now, when you have the Democrats up against the wall on this, force them to admit this, they actually come up with what I would call the escape hatch. And their escape hatch is the big switch. The big switch is usually accompanied by another phrase, the Southern strategy. And the basic idea here is that the two parties switched platforms. They switched. It's kind of like going around saying, you know, in a certain date in the 1960s, the cops all became robbers, and the robbers all became cops. There was a big switch. I mean, on the face of it, it's a little implausible, but the whole idea here is that Richard Nixon, Tricky Dick, was the one who pulled off the big switch by making racist appeals to the segregationist South, peeling over the Dixiecrats and the segregationists from the Democratic Party and making them into Republicans. Again, this history is almost never contested. It's in the textbooks, it's what young people learn, that sure, the Democratic Party may have been the bad guys then, but they've become the good guys now. The only truth of it is, when you really look at it, you realize this whole business about the Southern strategy, the big switch, it's all completely bogus. True, African Americans did switch from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, but they switched in the 1930s. FDR got 75% of the black vote in 1936. And the Democratic Party then was clearly the party of segregation and the Ku Klux Klan. So the reason blacks moved over to the Democratic Party had nothing to do with civil rights or race. It had to do basically with the economic benefits of the New Deal. I'm not faulting blacks. It was the teeth of the Depression. Blacks were living in the terrible conditions of the segregated South. But that was the reason for the black switch. And as for the Republican Party, if you were to draw a chart, you would have to say that through the 20th century, as the South became less racist, it became more Republican. The lines of racism and republicanism run in inverse directions. And ultimately, it was Reagan. It was under Reagan that the South finally came over to the Republican camp. And it was not because of bigotry. It was Reagan's appeals to patriotism, anti-communism, the pro-life issue, free markets. It was a whole ensemble of economic, foreign policy, and social issues that brought over the South into the Republican Party. I've talked for a little bit about race. I want to pivot slightly now and talk about fascism. Because the fascist card, like the race card, is a complete fake. A complete fake. Fascism has always been a phenomenon of the left. In fact, the term fascist refers to a bunch of sticks tied tightly together. In other words, it refers to collectivism. It refers to the fascists like to say that a nation is like a living organism. And every individual is a cell within that organism. In other words, does the cell have any rights? No. Does the cell have any value or identity apart from the nation? No. So the fascists like to say that the cell is only valuable insofar as it serves the state. This is the core meaning of fascism. Mussolini was a leftist, he was a Marxist, he was in fact the most famous socialist in Italy, he was a friend of Lenin. When Mussolini started the fascist party in Italy, the first fascist party in the world, Lenin sends him a telegram of congratulations. Hitler, we all know, was a national socialist. He was head of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And the Nazi platform, which, you know, wonderfully, this is one advantage of speaking to young people these days, is I tell them, listen, you don't have to believe anything I say. The good thing about living today is you can simply turn on your phone and check. So the nice thing is you can go into your phone and put in the Nazi 25-point platform. And there it is, and you can read it. And here's the interesting thing. If you take the Nazi 25-point platform, cross out the word usury, which is a little antiquated, write in its meaning interest. Cross out the word Jew, and write in the word the top 1%. The Nazi platform reads like it was jointly drafted by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. In fact, I predict that if you stood up and read the Nazi platform with these two small changes I just recommended at the Democratic National Convention, you would get thunderous and virtually uninterrupted applause. Without revealing its source, of course. So, now, in the 1930s, the Democrats and the progressives were absolutely enamored by fascism. FDR was a huge fan of Mussolini's. FDR sent members of his brain trust to fascist Rome to study fascism. He thought fascism was more leftist, which it was, more progressive than the New Deal, and he wanted to bring fascist ideas to America. Mussolini, for his part, liked FDR. Mussolini reviews FDR's book called Looking Forward in an Italian magazine, and the review can be summarized in this way. FDR is one of us. He's a fascist. And so what you have in the 30s is this mutual admiration society between not just Italian fascism. Let me tell you a little interesting nugget about the Germans. So in 1935, the Nazis, the senior Nazis, get together at the Justice Department, and they're drafting the Nuremberg Laws, which basically made Jews into second-class citizens. And the Nazis are super excited, and they have a stenographer there, and that's how we know about it. We have the transcripts. And the Nazis declare publicly, we are creating right here and now in Nuremberg the world's first racist state. And one of the Nazis, a guy named Krieger, puts up his hand and he goes, I'm very sorry to say this, but we cannot create the world's first racist state because the world's first racist state has already been created in America by the Democratic Party. And the Nazis are like shocked. They can't believe it. And this guy explains, he says, listen, he says, what do we want to do to the Jews? He goes, first of all, we want to forbid intermarriage between Jews and other Germans. He goes, throughout the Democratic South, you have miscegenation laws that do exactly that. Blacks and whites are not allowed to intermarry. And then we want to segregate the Jews into ghettos. He goes, in America, they already have segregation. And then we want to have state-sponsored discrimination against the Jews, confiscate their property and so on. They've got that already in the United States. Now, it may seem odd to hear a Nazi talk about the Democrats. Why? Because there's a sort of little missing piece of information that once again appears in no American textbook, and that is that every segregation law in the American South, everyone, was passed by a Democratic legislature, signed by a Democratic governor, and put into effect by Democratic officials. There is no exception to this rule. So segregation was from start to finish a work of the Democratic Party. The Nazis knew this, even though American students today don't. And so the Nazis were giving credit where credit is due. And the Nazis, believe it or not, adjourned the meeting, got a hold of the Democratic laws, crossed out the word black, wrote in the word Jew, and that's what we call the Nuremberg Laws. The Nuremberg Laws were lifted, almost verbatim, from the blueprint supplied by the Democratic Party in the United States. And there's one revealing tidbit about this. At one point, the Nazis faced a really sticky issue. Who is a Jew? If you think about it, there had been hundreds of years of intermarriage. There were Jews who were practicing and Jews who were non-practicing. So how do you classify a Jew? And the Nazis were scratching their heads. They didn't know how to do it. So Krieger, the guy who had studied in Arkansas, the Nazi who studied in America, he goes, I have the solution. It's from the Democrats again. The Democrats have invented in America something called the one-drop rule. It basically means that if you have one drop of black blood, you're black. And what's really interesting is that the Nazis look at each other and they basically go, that's too racist even for us. That's too much. We can't go that far. And they didn't. In fact, if you read the Nuremberg Laws now, essentially in order to be Jewish, you have to have three Jewish grandparents. So the point I'm trying to make is the Nazis took a softer line on racial identification than the Democrats whose example they were actually examining at the time. Now, I tell you this not just because, I tell you this because when I ran into it, discovered it, and here I'm sitting with the transcripts of the actual meetings, it crosses my mind that I have never heard this in my adult life. It has never been taught at Dartmouth where I studied. I've never spoken to anyone who's ever mentioned it. It's not in any textbook and so on. And yet here it is, irrefutable in the historical record. It's undeniable. It's right there. And then I realized that what we're dealing with here in America is the fact that the history, that the story of America that's come down to us has been doctored. It's been rigged. Important, and just as we see in the news, important information is left out. Things are ignored. When I made the movie Hillary's America, yesterday I was watching CNN and they were complaining. They were like, we are trying to get Marco Rubio to come and talk on CNN about gun control, but he's avoiding us. What has he got to hide? And I was thinking to myself, well, last year I released a movie on the history of the Democratic Party. It was in over 1,000 theaters. It couldn't be more current. It was about the election. And yet, I was never invited once to come and talk about it on CNN. What do you guys have to hide? Right? But what I'm saying is that, interestingly, this principle of let's just leave that out doesn't just apply to CNN. It also applies to the books we read. It also applies to the knowledge that we often take for granted as educated people in this country. Now, the real fascism that we have to worry about today is not just Antifa. Like I mentioned before, these Antifa characters are complete losers. Many of them are semi-illiterate. They're angry. They've been infused with this entitlement mentality. They've been told that those are the bad guys. They've told that you can be heroic even though you got turned down for your job application at Starbucks. There's a valiant career waiting for you. Nazi fighter. You can be an anti-fascist of the 21st century. And so these guys literally come surfacing out of their basements. They go look around for their sticks and baseball bats. But the real fascism in America isn't those guys. In fact, at Berkeley, the most dangerous fascist is the mayor of Berkeley, this guy Jesse Aragon. Why? Because he's the guy who calls the cops off. He's the guy who pulls the cops back so that the anti-fascists can beat up the conservative speaker who's coming to campus. And the most dangerous fascists are the Hollywood bosses. These are people who can take a young conservative screenwriter and make sure he never works in that town again. Or Google. Some guy writes a memo criticizing their diversity policy. He's out on the street. Or the deans who control billion-dollar endowments. They can take a young academic who's trying to make it, a young conservative, but if he's not on the reservation, They'll destroy his career in embryo before it even gets going. And then the guys in Washington, starting with Obama, who used the weapons of the state against their political opponents. The IRS, the FBI, the Justice Department. When my little case surfaced, it was for me kind of terrifying. Frankly, there were a whole bunch of FBI agents assigned to my case alone. I now have, through a Congressional Oversight Committee, my file. And in my case file, right there, it red flags me. This man is a prominent critic of the Obama administration. Right away, you see the political motivation. Now, hey, I know in this room it's a badge of honor. But when you get Eric Holder in a room, and then Preet Bharara, and all these Obama guys, and then a Clinton appointee judge, and then I'm standing in a courtroom and I hear this, United States of America versus Dinesh D'Souza. Wow. I mean, as an immigrant, I have to tell you, that sends a chill down your spine. And it shakes your patriotism to a degree, because you immediately realize that, you know, I've come to this country, which has meant everything to me, the American dream, but there's a whole bunch of really powerful people who would snuff out my American dream in a minute if they had the chance to do it. And we live in a time when even the post office and the Bureau of Land Management has a SWAT team. And when they come to your door, it's not four guys in a suit with a folder. It's police cars and helicopters overhead and automatic weapons trained on your windows. And this is the America we live in now. And we see, as these investigations begin to unfold and we can look under the rocks, we begin to see how these institutions have become corrupted. Corrupted by the left, which has been willing for the first time to use them, to weaponize them against us. Now, what this shows you is that things are now out of control. They're out of control. This is not, by the way, I mean, this is not Jimmy Carter's Democratic Party. Obama and Jimmy Carter are two very different guys. I mean, if we were handing out the award for presidential nincompoopery, we'd have to give it to Carter, hands down. He's the winner. But that's not Obama. With Obama, a lot of these things, even though we persist in describing Obama as he was incompetent. Obama was actually very competent. He was very competent in doing the things that he set out to do. The reason that Obama didn't fix the economy is that wasn't really his interest at all. Ultimately, Obama was an Alinskyite radical. And if you read Alinsky carefully, let me give you an example of what we're dealing with when we're talking about Alinsky. A very shrewd guy, by the way, Alinsky, who studied by his own admission at the feet of the mafia. And Alinsky was, in the 60s, approached by a group of young leftists who said, a Republican is coming to speak. We are going to show up with signs saying that the Republican speaker has the same views as the Ku Klux Klan. Now, think about this. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, the Klan was, in fact, I'm quoting the progressive historian Eric Foner, the Klan was the domestic terrorist arm of the Democratic Party, end quote. So Alinsky knows this. But Alinsky loves the idea of smearing the Republicans with the Ku Klux Klan. But what Alinsky tells these young leftists is the following. He goes, you're idiots. He goes, you show up with these dumb posters, nobody cares. He goes, here's what you should do. Go out to the store and buy some white sheets. Dress up like the Ku Klux Klan. Show up as Klansmen to the talk. Then when the Republicans start speaking, wildly cheer everything he says and go, you're right, the Klan agrees with you. This is fantastic. And then let the press take your picture. Now, you have to admit that this is the kind of thinking that in the poem Paradise Lost, Milton puts into the mind of Lucifer. It's ingenious, it's diabolical, it's unbelievably hard-hitting. It's the kind of thing from which a Republican speaker can never recover. Here you are giving a benign speech about patriotism, and here's the Ku Klux Klan cheering you in the front row. That's Alinsky, that's Obama. This is the other side. Now, this is not our side. If I go out on social media tonight and tweet something out, within 60 seconds, 5 paid leftists will be on my Twitter attacking and insulting me in every possible way. They'll attack Debbie, they'll attack me, you're a felon. What are they trying to do? They're trying to drive me from public life. They're trying to humiliate me, they're trying to make me go, it's not worth it. Essentially, they are slaughtering me on social media, and they're paid to do it, and there's a whole bunch of them. There's nothing equivalent on the other side. Nancy Pelosi goes on Twitter. We don't have a bunch of Republicans who go there, who attack her, make fun of her looks, make fun of her family, attack her grandchildren. I mean, we don't even think this way. I mean, I do, but... The point I'm trying to make is that there's an inequity of ferocity on the two sides. Look at the Supreme Court. The vast majority of Supreme Court nominees are Republicans. But right now we don't have a Supreme Court clear majority. Why not? Because we operate in this mode. I wonder what Anthony Kennedy is going to do today. I wonder what he's feeling. Hey, we got Kennedy. Whoops, we lost Roberts. The Democrats can count with Euclidean certainty on their votes. They have 4 votes, they're gonna get 4 votes every single time. Why? Because their guys go on the court to be good Democrats. And our guys go on the court to read the Constitution. So let me suggest, what I'm getting at with all this is that we are in a sort of a kind of a brawl. Of a kind that I haven't seen in my adult life with the Democrats. And Trump has only raised the stakes. In some ways, Trump is the result of the brawl. Because I think Republicans said, wait a minute, we've been appointing all these nice guys. Consider Romney. I mean, this guy is unimpeachable. I don't think anyone since Jesus Christ has a better resume. They got nothing on this guy. And yet, when he's the nominee, within about 30 days, the left makes him into Lucifer. Why? Partly because Romney is so defensive. Hey, Romney, you're a rich plutocrat. You've been ripping off the poor, and so on. And Romney's like, oh, no, I'm not. No, really, really, I'm not. Now, notice the difference between Romney and Trump. Trump has a lot more money than Romney. But nobody attacks Trump for being rich. Why? Because you can't. If you accuse him of being rich, he sits you down and explains to you that he's even richer than you thought. Doesn't do a whole lot of good. As Republicans, we have to recognize that we have been and we are the good guys. We've actually been the good guys all along. That's our history. The parties never switched. When Abraham Lincoln was asked to define slavery, he defined slavery in this way. You work, I eat. That's the essence of slavery. You're stealing another guy's labor. You're making him work for you for free. And Lincoln's whole idea was that the man who makes the corn has the right to put the corn into his own mouth. In other words, people have a right to keep the fruits of their labor. And so I ask you, here we are, more than 150 years later, and it seems to me that's still the platform of the Republican Party. People should get to keep their own stuff. And the core of the Democratic Party, even today, is you work, I eat. Even today, redistribution and wealth confiscation is the core of what the Democratic Party represents. We have to fight, but we also have to fight creatively, effectively, and fearlessly. And if Trump had a single quality I'd like to italicize, It's his unbelievable bravery. Trump is willing to go where no Republican is willing to go. And this bravery is such a rare political virtue that even if I think that Trump is acting recklessly, even if I think that in this particular case he's going too far, I would rather have him go too far and hit hard rather than cower in the background and get absolutely surrounded and destroyed. And Trump's greatest bravery has been essentially to take the elaborately constructed high walls of American politics that have been constructed by the media to force every political creature to walk in between those walls. In other words, to shape the parameters of American political debate. And Trump ignores them. He ignores the walls, he refuses to accept those limits, and that's something that we can learn from him. When I was in college, and I'll close on this note, I heard from one of my professors a story of the lion tamer and the lion. Very interesting situation. Here's the lion tamer, kind of a little guy with a stick, and here's the lion, big ferocious lion. And the lion tamer is doing little twirls with the stick, and the lion is kind of following the lead of the lion tamer. And so now my professor poses a question: who is actually more powerful, the lion tamer or the lion? Well, it's the lion. But now we have a mystery. If the lion is more powerful, why is the lion so sycophantically, obediently following the instructions of the lion tamer? And the answer is that the lion doesn't know its own power. The lion thinks the lion tamer is more powerful. And that's kind of our situation in this room. We're actually a very influential group. Most of us don't use most of our influence. One way to do it, by the way, is social media. People say, well, social media, I only have 30 friends on Facebook. Yeah, but they've got 30 friends on Facebook. Today you can get out information in a way that you simply couldn't in the past. So what we have is we are intimidated by these lion tamers out there in the media, in the universities, the experts, the elites, because they intimidate us into submission. And I think one of the reasons that the media is so unnerved by Trump is that they are doing the intimidation routine, and it doesn't seem to be working. It's somehow Trump doesn't get it. And what I'm suggesting is that we have got to, many of us who have been actually somewhat marching in lockstep, have got to stop getting it. I have to say, in my own career, the reason I make movies, I mean, I was a think tank guy. I'd write books and articles. I thought American politics was a sort of intellectual debate between our side and their side, which both had different priorities. We believe in liberty. They believe in equality. We believe in equality of rights. They believe in equality of results. But then you come across people like Bill and Hillary Clinton, and you realize American politics for them is not a debate. American politics for them is a heist. This is basically the Duke and the Dauphin right out of Mark Twain. And their whole gig is not how do we advance the debate. Their whole gig is how do we stay one step ahead of the posse. And so as I encounter the justice system and people like Eric Holder and these guys, and I realize the debate is only the surface of American politics. Underneath, you have these much deeper motives of hatred and ambition and lust and revenge. And those are very powerful motors of politics too. And we as Republicans will never win until we not only realize that, but appeal to that, appeal to it. So a movie is different than a book. A book is sort of like an intellectual argument. A movie is not that. A movie is an emotional experience. Very often conservative and Christian movies flop because our team is trying to do messaging. The most important thing in a movie is to draw the emotions of the audience. Now, if you do that and you entertain them, then you can put all kinds of messaging in and people will happily digest it. But if you fail to do that, your movie tanks. And so one reason I do the films is I realize that not only is this a very powerful medium, think about it, a movie engages all your senses. It's a visual experience, it's an oral experience, your mind is engaged, your heart is engaged. You can come out of a movie in 90 minutes a little transformed, a little different person than you were if it's a really good movie than when you went in 90 minutes earlier. A book can't do that. And also a movie reaches people that books can't reach. My most successful books, number one in the New York Times bestseller list, 200,000 copies. My least successful movie is seen in the theater by 2 million people and by another 2 million people in DVD, and we'll release our new film this summer. It's probably going to be called Death of a Nation. No. And it takes some of these ideas we've talked about. It's one thing to talk about them. It's another thing to put them on the big screen. And this is really why the left, in a sense, and notice what they'll do when the movie comes out, they will go into a rabbit hole. All the people who've been bloviating about fascism every day, George Stephanopoulos, Van Jones, Chris Matthews, Rachel Maddow, all these so-called, you know, experts on fascism, all these people educated way beyond their intelligence. And so they like to have some Republicans on because they like to have them on to pummel them. But when I put this movie out this summer, they won't have me on. Because their point is, we can't have Dinesh on, he's going to make us look like a fool in 60 seconds. So they won't take that chance. Let's remember that we are the lion, and the power ultimately is with us. Here in Nevada, you have the power in this room to move the state back into the red column. You have it. So use it. And America, this America that has meant so much to us, this America that has given us our dreams and given us the kind of life that we couldn't have anywhere else in the world, this America is, its fate, perhaps by tragic necessity, is in the hands of us as Republicans. May we be worthy of it. May we be like the lion, and may we learn to roar. Thank you very much.